Business, Transportation, and Workforce Development for Thursday. And members, we will see, depending on the testimony we get from our esteemed witnesses today, whether we can be as efficient yesterday or whether they will raise more questions than answers, and we will see. But one thing, I want to compliment the committee and Janet for the great work that everybody's been doing this session. I think, as you have noticed with our workload and our tentative schedule, we still have some bills coming over from the House, of course, but I think we're in very, very good shape in this committee to address all the issues that need to be addressed. And I certainly hope that all the committees in this chamber will be the same to address all the important issues as they come over with 2 weeks left to go in hearings. Oh, I see the majority leader is here. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2456. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2456, and you should have the A engrossed version, prohibits the State Board of Education from allowing the use of school buses that were manufactured before April 1st, 1977, making operation of such a prohibited school bus a Class B traffic violation. August 1st, 2008 would be the effective date. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a fiscal impact statement at your place as well.
Thank you very much. Representative Hunt, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to be here. The only reason you all are so efficient is because you stole Janet Atkins from the House Committee consideration. I think about half of our committee chairs wanted Janet, but nice job in successfully winning her.
Seniority does have its privileges.
For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County, the bill before you, 2456A, is really a simple bill. We've had there, if you look at the manufacturing of school buses, you really have an era before 1977 and since 1977. In 77, there were federal standards adopted that required a whole variety of things, bus emergency exits, window retention and release mechanisms, bus rollover protections in terms of the cages at the top, making sure that the joints were strong, the way they did the seating and crash protection, the higher back seats and better padding. Fuel system integrity in terms of not having fuel systems that ignite. They basically made a whole series of standards. So buses since 1977 have all these standards. Unfortunately, we still have some school buses transporting kids every day in Oregon that are pre-77. And so this bill would require them to stop. You'll see the original bill would have given them just until August of this year. At the request of the Oregon School Board Association, we gave them one additional year till August of 2008. But by August of 2008, all the buses transporting kids in Oregon would have to be post-1977. It's really a school bus kid safety issue.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for the Representative?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. Welcome. Does the State Board of Education have jurisdiction over the private schools? And how would this affect private schools and charter schools?
Excellent question, Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson. There are, I believe, two private schools that are operating. This does impact private schools as well. I believe there are two private schools that do have buses pre-77. One of those, I believe, has already purchased a post-77 bus, anticipating this legislation coming. And I believe the other school district, in addition to the public school districts that have these buses, are already in process, knowing this is coming, are now in process of purchasing buses to make sure they're in compliance. But, yes, it does impact any kids being transported, public or private.
And a follow-up, do you have stats as to that there's been accidents, these buses are prone, are there accidents, is there a real safety issue? I remember going in these buses, this is way back when.
It was in pre-37.
And we'd have to go to Astoria. Gresham High had to pull, Astoria was in our league, so we had to go over the mountain. I'm just curious.
Yeah.
And for activities buses too. I know they may use different kinds of buses for activities also.
Exactly. Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, the U.S. Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Administration, I think is the right name of the agency. They have statistics about a whole variety of accidents, unfortunately, that have occurred in buses. Fortunately, Oregon, at least in recent years, I am not aware has had accident with these buses. It's just because we've been lucky, because we still have several districts that are still utilizing them. But definitely these buses have been involved in a series of accidents. And if you look at the comparable data...
Do you have that information for us?
We can get that for you. I don't have that. In fact, folks from the agency, I believe, are behind me. The School Board Association would have that. Fortunately, the problem has been in other states dominantly, because most of our school districts have purchased buses post-77. I would also remind us, I think we're all familiar with the way that buses are purchased. When the school district purchases a bus, the state, through the formula that we already have in place, basically pays down 10%. They front the money, and the state pays down 10% of that cost over time. So much as we reimburse, it's separate from the bus operating dollars that we give them each year. That capital investment actually does get reimbursed by the state. It does require their upfront investment to make sure they have safe buses.
Yeah, and one final is, I would hate to mandate something to the school districts when they can't afford it. And I don't know if there are districts that this would affect, but I would assume that the ones you posted were in Enterprise school districts, but I was just had a concern for the charter schools and the private schools.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, it is just the two schools, as I said, the two private schools, one of which is already purchased and the other is in process. And Mr. Green from OSBA can give you the school board's perspective on this. I believe he's in the room behind me.
Well, thank you very much. I know you're busy. I'll let you go, and we'll ask those folks to come forward. Thank you.
Thanks,
Mr. Chair. Marianne Guest, Deborah Lincoln, Jim Green. This bill from 03. That's what it's useful to check out. Not about it. So. He waited about. Chip waited about. Start wherever, whoever.
Deborah.
Okay, Deborah.
Also organized here. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Deborah Lincoln. I'm the Director of Pupil Transportation for the Department of Education. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2456, even with its amendments. Some of this might be a little bit redundant, so I'll try to skip over it, what you've already heard. But National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, regulates the construction standards for school buses. And they do this Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, and they establish these standards for cars, trucks, and passenger vehicles, as well as school buses. There are 36 Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards that apply to school buses. These cover a range of brakes, steering, blazing lights, fuel system, integrity of mirrors, defrosters. I've provided you with a blow-up of the different Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards that apply for school buses. I'd like to just briefly touch on some that are really important. 111 applies to the mirrors, so that from the seated position, the driver is able to see alongside in front of the mirror, in front of the bus. 217 applies to the exit requirements, so that per seat there's a formula so that there's enough exits to get out in case of a serious fire or emergency. 302 applies to the flammability of the seats. And then additionally, there are four that apply specifically only to school buses. 131 is the school bus pedestrian safety devices. That is the school bus red light that you see on top and the stop arm that comes out to the side. But really what's important here I'd like to point out is 220, which is the rollover protection that signifies the joint strength, 2 and 221. And you'll see in the blow-up how it has a cage that goes over the roof of the bus. And then 222, it has to do with the seating and how the seats are attached. According to National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, school buses are the safest form of transportation. And however, buses manufactured prior to April 1, 1977, do not meet any of these Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards. Oregon is one of the only few states left in the nation that allow pre-77 buses. And there are 12 currently in use in the state of Oregon, one in Bend School District, one in Salem Academy, one at Blanchett, four in Enterprise, and five in Wallawa School Districts. All these school districts have been notified, and we've been encouraging them for some time to get rid of pre-77 buses. The only real problem that I can see is Enterprise and Wallawa School District, and they receive transportation from a contractor, Moffitt Brothers. I've also talked to Moffitt Brothers and told them about the existence of this bill. I've discussed with both school districts the options that have they have before them. They could purchase equipment that's already in the state with the manufacture date after 1993, or if they were able to find vehicles that are newer or that come from another state that don't currently meet Oregon specifications, we would be able to grant them a variance. The Department of Education has been very proactive in helping the school districts upgrade their fleet, and they do that by that school funding formula. We do reimburse districts at 10% per year to purchase school buses per statutory requirement, ORS 327.033. That money is to be put into a fund that they account separately that they can only purchase new school buses with. Or a school bus history in Oregon is an excellent safety record, and I think in part it has to do with the equipment that we have and also the well-trained caring drivers. And it might be of interest that we have not had an accident that we have kept track since the department has been keeping track of statistics. We have not had a fatal accident in Oregon since 1976, which was in a pre-77 bus in which we had three fatalities. So for these reasons, I would urge you to support House Bill 2456, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. I think we'll go through our panelists, and then we'll get everything on the table, and we'll see if there's questions.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't want to repeat what Deborah just said.
State your name first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mary Ann Guest, representing Oregon School Employees Association. So I won't repeat what Deborah said. This is really a safety and health issue for not only our bus drivers, but also the children that ride on the bus. We wholeheartedly support the bill and reluctantly support moving the implementation date out a year. We think that these buses need to be off the road. We understand that Moffitt Brothers, or whatever they're called, in Wallawa, et cetera, are really struggling and are going to replace the buses. So as long as they're off the road, I think that we could support the bill with the implementation date out a year.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Board Association, and we're here also appearing in support of House Bill 2456 with the A engrossed version. And I'd like to thank Representative Hunt and his staff, Trevor Sleeman, for the work that they've done on this bill and working with our association on the amendment. And let me talk a little bit about that amendment. It does push it back a year. When I called Brad Royce, who's the superintendent of the Enterprise School District, and Mark Thielman, who's the superintendent of Wallawa, they are a little bit unique. If any of you have been to Wallawa County, there are three roads in and out of the county, and there is one transportation provider up there. It's Moffitt Brothers Transportation, and they do have the largest number. They have nine up there of these pre-77 buses, and I said, this bill's going to go, and it's going to go this time. When is it, and what's the implementation date that you guys can live with? And we agreed on an August 1, 2008 date. And in talking with Brad Royce, the superintendent of Enterprise, he is working with Moffitt Brothers to ensure that those buses that are pre-77 don't go outside the city limits. Because if you're familiar with Enterprise, Oregon, it has a large attendance boundary. As a matter of fact, it goes all the way out to Troy and Flora, which is almost to the Washington border out there. It's 45 miles one way out to those school districts. And he's trying to ensure that Moffitt Brothers will not run the pre-77 buses out on those routes, but only on the in-town route within Enterprise, and the same for the Wallawa School District. So we appreciate Representative Hunt, the Oregon School Employees Association, and the Oregon Department of Education supporting us in getting rid of these. Several sessions ago, and I'm sure Senator Starr will remember, several sessions ago, a bill like this was introduced, I believe at the request of the Oregon School Employees Association, and we had well in excess of 150 of these buses in the state. the largest number in the Hillsborough School District. And I believe at that time they understood what it meant to get rid of these buses, and they did it.
Yeah.
You don't see these in Hillsborough anymore. But just because of the economics of it up in Wallowa County, it's not working. So I do appreciate Representative Hunt and his office working with us on an amendment and supporting that. And we'd urge you to pass this bill out today, and let's get it implemented.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, questions from the committee? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, I got to tell you, here's my general policy when it comes to everybody, when it comes to local school boards. I don't vote for mandates. I don't vote for mandates because I think you can make the decisions at the board level and the school employee level. And from the testimony, you guys are already saying everybody's working to get rid of these buses. I have a hard time sit up here passing a piece of legislation on a school district like Enterprise and Wallowa, telling them what they're going to do, especially if they're making considerations already, and especially since the evidence is we haven't had a lot of accidents that have created this problem. I understand the 77 primarily because of the placement of the fuel tanks. Believe me, I'm aware of that. But I'm having a hard time philosophically figuring out why we're mandating if there's incentive and cooperative-based programs where we can, as a state, I mean, if this bill said we were going to go out and say to Wallowa County, we're going to grant you a couple $100,000 extra to get these buses off there, and that we as a legislature was going to do that, I'd be fine with that. But how come this is a mandate, not an incentive-based program?
And Mr. Chairman, Senator George, our association generally doesn't support mandates. And on this issue, that's why we have traditionally opposed this bill and helped defeat this bill in the past. We're down to 12 of these buses, and I believe that something may happen with regard to these buses, and Lord help the school district that may occur in. And our issue here is trying to protect the kids and trying to eliminate the liability that those school districts may have. I'd support an incentive program for those school districts. Remember, those school districts up in Wallowa County are declining enrollment school districts. They're losing kids. You know, there's not an economy base up there that's keeping kids there. It's a farming community. Used to be farming and timber. They don't have the timber industry up there anymore. I think most of the mills now in Joseph are closed up in the county. But they are struggling with finances up there, and I'd love to see an incentive-based program to help them get these buses. But they have contracted with Moffitt Brothers. The contractor knows this issue is coming forward. I think they could probably work through it if we didn't have the bill, but I think just for safety standards, it's probably the best thing to do to put the bill in. And I agree with you. We generally don't support mandates. This is one because of safety and liability that could potentially face our school districts. We're going to be in support of this time. But I know Senator Metzger and Senator Starr, we've marched up this hill several sessions. And have been in opposition to this bill in the past, but we are now in support. We've got most of our districts to get rid of these just for the safety issue. And I think without a date there certain, you may not see the private schools and or the charter schools. And I don't believe there's charter schools that have any that I'm recalling right now. Deborah may know, or Ms. Lincoln may know a little bit more about that. But I think without a date there, you probably wouldn't see these buses get off the road for some entities out there.
Questions.
Can I come on that? May I come on that?
Yeah. Oh, yes, you may.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, Senator George. There really isn't an incentive for Moffitt Brothers to replace those buses. And as hard as I have been working for years to get pre-77 buses off the road, there is no reason for them to remove them. They're a business, and they don't get reimbursement from the Department of Education. And yet they have a fleet of gravel trucks that they keep updated. So, and they also have a business that runs motor coaches, and you don't see those vehicles very old. So I don't see, from my discussion with them, they have no intention of updating this fleet. And so I think they do need some incentive to encourage them to get rid of pre-77 buses. As far as the charter buses, the charter schools, and there aren't any charter school districts that are using pre-77 buses. Question?
Yes, Senator Moss.
How much does a bus cost?
Average. Chair Metzger, Senator Moss Anderson, there's several different things that could make a bus be more or less. Approximately for a conventional style bus, that's the one with the nose out in front, just a plain 66 passenger is probably about $70,000. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Right. Senator Starr.
From the testimony, you say that only two private schools have buses, pre-77 buses. How do you know that?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr. I know that because every bus that is used for student transportation has to receive an annual and is in a database that the department keeps. And so it's easy for me to query the dates. And I just pulled up a list that's anything older than 1977. And the one bus that was at Salem Academy, when I talked to them, they said, good, they don't want to use it. And the other bus at Blanchett, they had already purchased a new bus that they're planning on getting rid of that old bus.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Does this law in any way restrict the use of pre-77 buses as it relates to movement of persons, kids, I guess, for, say, a church who's taking their kids to the summer camp or, you know, wherever?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr. The bill only talks about school children, and so if it is a private church school and they are moving school children for an event, whether it's to a camp if it's related to the school, then they would be under the authority of the Department of Ed, and yes, this would affect it. If it is a church activity, then the department doesn't have any authority over that, and I don't think this bill would take care of that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, one of the questions I got asked on this bill from a family member who has agricultural interests said, does this affect, you know, an agricultural person using these to transport workers from field to field? And the answer to that question is no, because this bill is related for school activities, school buses. So the answer there would be no. Those individuals, you know, if farmers wanted to buy them to move workers from one field to another field, that is not included in this piece of legislation.
Okay. Any other questions? Anybody else wish to testify on this bill? Okay, well, let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2456, and we'll take a look at it again later. Okay, let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2520. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2520 was introduced at the request of the Oregon Farm Bureau and would amend the definition of a Class 2 ATV to include motor vehicles that are being operated on a highway for agricultural purposes, including transportation between ranching or farming headquarters, agricultural fields, or pastures. But it would require the person that's operating the ATV for such purposes to hold a valid driver's license, comply with posted speed limits, and to drive to the right-hand edge of the highway. Mr. Chair, the Class 2 ATVs are the Jeep style. We've been talking about Class 1s and 3s, but they're the Class 2? No, not Jeep style. Okay, Mr. Chair, I'm mistaken. Thank you. But they are not street legal, but this would allow them to be used for agricultural purposes on the highway. Thank you.
Don Kurt, you want to come forward? Funny to have an ATV in the description and the room's not full.
We don't know what to do about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don Schoenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. And with me is Mr. Kurt Mazet from Tillamook, one who brought this issue to our attention. ATVs are a very common part of the equipment on nearly every farm and ranch in Oregon, except mine. I'd like to have one. I keep trying to talk my wife into letting me get one, but so far that hasn't worked. They can do some of the work of a sheepdog, a horse, a small tractor, the pickup, and a spray buggy. We appreciate the provision in the current law, Section 2 of the bill, that allows us to legally move them from farm headquarters to the field, from field to field, using the public road in a safe manner. And the committee administrator already told you what those conditions were, so I won't go into that. Quite frankly, House Bill 2520 was introduced to prevent a problem. However, and that problem would be that someone would be cited for using one and moving it on the road. But I have since heard of at least one citation that has been issued for moving a Class 2 ATV on a public road, so I guess it was just a matter of time. Because of the utility and efficiency of an ATV, manufacturers have been producing slightly larger ones, and farmers and ranchers have quickly recognized how they can be used on the farm. Some may have a flat deck behind the seat for carrying bales of hay, while others may have a box for transporting items that do not stack well or small animals. And some are fairly enclosed to protect the operator from the weather. For example, I just noticed yesterday again that the Capital Ground crew has what's called a Kawasaki Mule. That would be a Class 2 type ATV. The purpose of the bill in Section 1 is to allow Class 2 ATVs to be moved on the road from one location to another under the same provisions as Class 1 ATVs, which is your normal, used to be three-wheelers. Now they're pretty much all what they call quads. They have four wheels instead of three wheels. And so this, and then Section 3 of the bill is just conforming amendments that adds Class ATVs to this list of vehicles that must display a slow-moving vehicle sign. So the Oregon Farm Bureau, of course, supports this bill and would ask for your support of House Bill 2520 and send it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. You would like to
I think we will. Hear from Kurt.
Mazzei,
yeah.
And then we'll be happy to answer questions.
Welcome.
Kurt Mazzei, 5190 Neatarts Highway, Tillamook. I have several reasons to be interested in this, primarily because I sell these type of vehicles, but also because I'm a fourth-generation dairyman, a nurseryman, a cranberry grower. And so all these things are used, you know, in those type of operations industry-wide, and I've talked to a lot of people within those industries, and most of, as Don was saying, were unaware that Class 2 ATVs were not implements of husbandry or, you know, just another item like a tractor they could take down the road. So House Bill 2520 essentially gives us the same latitude that we have with Class 1 ATVs as far as the ability to take them down public roads from farm to field and allow the farmer to use those in a manner that would make his operation more efficient. And, of course, there's the restrictions that were mentioned that would be identical for this purpose. The benefit to these machines is they can carry more. They're actually safer for on the road than the Class 1 ATV. They can carry an additional passenger more safely, that sort of thing. So I'd welcome any questions you have and urge your support for 2520.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to come, too. Questions? Any questions? Okay. The department has not signed up on this bill. Is there any reason you would like to testify on the bill? Okay. I'm not saying you have to, but okay. I assume that's why you didn't sign up. But since we're on the highways, we want to make it for the record that there was no objections voiced by the Department of Transportation. So close the public hearing on House Bill 2520. There's three of us here. Why don't we do a work session on House Bill 2520?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2520 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Mona Sanderson has moved House Bill 2520 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We'll mark Senator Deckert and Senator Starr as excused. And since Senator George is the farm family representative on the committee, we will ask if you could be kind enough to carry the bill to the floor.
No problem.
Okay, let's open up public hearing on House Bill 2119. Janet.
Chair and members, House Bill 2119 would prohibit the display of a registration plate or on a vehicle other than the vehicle for which the plate was issued, or display of a registration sticker that contains a different expiration date than the expiration date on the vehicle record for that vehicle. Mr. Chair, this was pre-session filed for the Department of State Police.
Thank you very much. Alan Hagman. Welcome. Thank
you. Hey, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. I'll just summarize my testimony here. Basically,
identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm Sergeant Alan Hagan with the Oregon State Police.
Thank you.
In the Patrol Division. And basically, the penalty for switching license plates or tags on a vehicle is the same as not having any tags or registration at all. So what we see occasionally is somebody that is unable to renew their vehicle registration will obtain tags or license plates from another vehicle and then affix it to their vehicle. Sometimes they're stolen, sometimes they're borrowed from another car that maybe isn't working. And it's only a Class D violation to do that, which is a $97 citation. What House Bill 2119 does is it revises ORS 803-550 to make it an offense to switch vehicle license plates or tags. And there's a knowingly language in there, so if this was done accidentally, it wouldn't be enforceable. And it elevates to a Class B violation, which is $242. So our whole objective here is to hopefully create a little bit of disincentive for switching license plates and tags. That's really all it is. That's all that I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Sergeant. Is it, how often does this happen, do you think? I mean, I know there's, your jurisdiction is different. We have cities and stuff, and is this kind of a common practice that we see?
Chair Metzger, member of the committee, I can only say anecdotally what I've observed. It's not infrequent. I don't have any statistics on how often it happens. I think it would be hard to capture because we don't have a statute that says specifically that this is unlawful. But it is, I'd say it's not uncommon to see.
Now, I think particularly with the registration fees approximating the fine, I could see why. I mean, in the old days where people would, probably the new days now, go out and siphon your gas, and now they come and take your sticker off your license plate and save a few bucks. That actually happened to me one time. They actually took my sticker, and I didn't. Okay, it's something you don't look for.
Right.
And then one day you just saw it's kind of ragged, and you realize that my green sticker was gone, and someone had taken the sticker off my license plate.
That's pretty hard to do, though, Mr. Chair.
Well, they had to take the whole hunk of them. You know, sometimes they'll stick together when they've been around. So you just bring it and then obviously glue and stick it on their plate, Oh, well. Senator George.
Yeah.
I digress.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sergeant, you said that if this bill doesn't apply, if it was done accidentally, and I'm trying to see in the bill where it was. At our farm, there's lots of registrations go through the farm operations. Sometimes if something was put on something differently, obviously there has to be some kind of criminal intent intent to evade. Where does it say it wouldn't be enforceable? In your testimony, you said it wouldn't be enforceable if it wasn't intent. I just didn't see it in the language of the engrossed.
Chairman, Senator George,
gotcha.
In the original language, did you find it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much. That's all my question.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Sergeant. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2119, and if you are comfortable with the three of us, we can move forward. Okay. Open up a work session on House Bill 2119.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2119 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Monica Sanderson has moved House Bill 2119 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Ordered. Please mark Senator Deckert and Senator Starr as excused. And Senator Monica Sanderson, I'll give you that one. Okay. Now let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2176. Janet.
Mr. Chair and members, House Bill 2176 establishes the responsibility for medical determinations by a medical determination officer to the Department of Transportation. Currently, that function is with the Department of Human Services. There is a fiscal impact statement on the bill, and this bill was pre-session filed for the Department of Human Services.
Okay, Grant Higginson and Jack Evans.
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
Chair Metzger and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I am the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And the reason that I'm here today is because the review of medical eligibility for DMV cases is one of the activities that's accomplished in my office. We've been working with the Department of Motor Vehicles on this bill since last session and are in support of the bill. There's a number of reasons why a person may have a driving license denied or suspended, and one of those is if there are physical or mental health reasons that make it inappropriate for a person who has problems like that and that cannot correctly operate a motor vehicle. So when the Department of Motor Vehicles determines there might be such a case, they refer those cases to the State Health Office, and we then review the information that we have on the case and give the person a medical eligibility certificate or deny such a certificate. We've been actually doing these reviews at the State Public Health Agency since the 1940s. For a number of years, that function was actually performed by physicians in the State Public Health Division. However, in the 1980s, it became pretty clear to us that this really was not a good fit for public health. Public health physicians, public health nurses really do not have the kind of skills to perform eligibility determinations. And so for the last 20 years or so, we've been, in essence, contracting this out to physicians who actually do this kind of work on a day-to-day basis. But the point here, I guess, is why do we think that we need to have a change, since we do have a process in place right now? And a few sessions ago, there really was a change in how we're supposed to be looking at medical eligibility, and this came through the Department of Motor Vehicles. And it changed the way we look at it from just a diagnosis-based system to really looking at the functional capacity of the driver. And so in changing that work, the Department of Motor Vehicles pulled together a team over there to really work on medical issues. And so they've been doing things like changing the criteria and changing forms. They've been doing a lot more in the way of outreach to the physician community, more data analysis, etc. And from our perspective, particularly because it's not such a good fit with public health, we think it would be a much better idea to have the reviewing physician actually be a part of that Department of Motor Vehicles teams rather than being outstationed somewhere else. We also think that there are some streamlining and other efficiencies that would be helpful for the program as well. And then you'll also notice that this is an A. and Gross version of the bill. There were some amendments. Almost all of them were very minor tweaks. The most substantive one was that there was a change to ensure that there is adequate due process if there is a case where the driver feels that a decision on their medical eligibility has been made in error. And with that, we'll close and be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Well, let's go to Mr. Evans first.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, and I won't add a whole lot to what Dr. Higginson has said, except that we're certainly in support of this. Pardon me. This serves two of our programs, one being the at-risk driver program, which deals with drivers that are impaired, as the doctor mentioned, and also with the CDL waiver program, which Motor Carrier operates. There are about 400 reviews each year that are conducted on that side. This would actually be helpful to us. We think that it'll increase the security and confidentiality of records rather than having to send them off. They'd be in-house. They'd also lend medical expertise, as the doctor suggested, to the development of the programs and rules and the outreach to the physician community. So we're thinking very positively about this. We also addressed the issue of the contested case hearing through an amendment last time. The concern was raised that the same administrative agency that was making the determination would also employ the physician, but with the ability to have a contested case hearing in front of an administrative law judge, everyone was satisfied that due process would be served. So we are in support of this program and urge your support.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Questions? Okay. You may have successfully punted this off to the Department of Transportation, Doctor. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2176 and open a work session on House Bill 2176.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2176 before with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
There was a concern that this would be put into the Department of Transportation, and they may not have due diligence, but I don't think that should be a problem.
I think the program is they've pretty well been kind of as you indicated that been outsourcing that already. This essentially is kind of codifying what our practice is now.
And you'd be outsourcing it also.
No, they've been outsourcing to the department. I think they're just,
I just
kind
need
of
a little clarification here.
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Evans. Thanks.
Chair Metzger, Senator Montes Anderson, we would receive the authority to have this position within DMV, and we'd actually hire a half-time physician for the position. And it would be a wash as far as the funding goes, because we've been paying for this for many, many years. And instead of contracting out with the Department of the Division of Public Health, we would be hiring a physician. And this was upon the recommendation of the Attorney General for reasons of liability and confidentiality. It was suggested that an in-house physician would be a better fit.
I'm sorry, I should have asked before. But so when we have a lot of problems or concerns by those my age with parents that are in their 80s and they don't want to give up their licenses, and there is a complaint that they're very concerned, then instead of going to their own physician, how do you deal with those types of concerns? Where
Chair Metzger, Senator Montes Anderson, there are two aspects to the at-risk driver program. One is voluntary, one is or mandatory, one is non-mandatory. The mandatory program is your mother's physician, let's say, would make a mandatory report to the Department of Motor Vehicles. We would then pursue that, and that may result in the immediate suspension of that individual's driver's license. That person can then go back and have their physician revisit that decision, or if it's a non-mandatory report, let's say from a police officer or a family member, then the DMV can ask that the person go back and get a clearance from their physician. The family physician, the primary caregiver, then examines the person and makes their report. The report, as well as other documentation, then is reviewed by the physician that we're contracting out with now, or that would be on staff. So they're not actually seeing the patient. They're reviewing the medical records and making a determination against medical criteria.
Okay. And so if eyesight is failing all of a sudden, nighttime driving, and a child, you know, I find out my dad really can't drive at night. How is that then processed? You talk to the doctor again the same way, and then have them report to the DMV and.
Chair Metzger, Senator Montes Anderson, in that case, that would be a non-mandatory report. You could make the report directly to DMV, and you would do it in writing and sign it. DMV then would ask that the driver come in within, I believe it's 60 days, for a test. And they'd have 60 days to come in and take a vision test and perhaps a driving test, depending upon what the individual problem was. Should they fail that, then their license would be suspended. If they don't come in within that 60-day period, in the following 30 days, they would receive a suspension letter anyway.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. All right. Yeah, are we in the work session? I can't remember.
Yes,
we are in the
yeah.
work session, yeah.
Did I already make a motion?
No, not yet.
No.
Okay, I move the bill to the Senate with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved HB 2176 to forward the due pass recommendation. Mm-hmm. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Please mark Senator Deckert as excused. And I guess it's my turn, so I'll carry this one. And just while I'm thinking about it, would ask unanimous consent to allow Senator Starr to vote on House Bills 2520 and 2119. If there's any objection. All right. So I'll reopen the work session on House Bill 2520. How do you vote?
Okay.
Senator Starr votes aye. Close the work session on House Bill 2520. Reopen the work session on House Bill 2119A. How do you vote, Senator Starr?
Votes aye.
Senator Starr votes aye. Close the work session. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Last bill for the day, folks. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2275. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2275 would require the operators and passengers of privately owned commercial vehicles to use safety belts. if the vehicle is designed or used primarily for transportation of property. Mr. Chair, this brings in a number of types of vehicles into the seatbelt requirement. If you look at the bill, line 5-8, ORS 811-210 is the safety belt requirement, and this is a list of people who are not required to wear safety belts. It would bring, again, delivery van type vehicles in, as well as smaller commercial vehicles that are used for commercial operations. And it would also, as the department will explain, bring in some pickups that might be used for other purposes but do carry passengers. They are used in a business, but they're just regular pickups. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Costellos.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costellos, Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. House Bill 2275 comes to you in a proactive move. Recall during the last session, actually with this committee, Chairman is primary sponsor of the bill, an unfortunate incident in the Portland area with the mother of a figure skater that was killed in a traffic crash in a vehicle that was created and used to transport people and brought up the issue of some of the exemptions in our law that were left over from the debates in this building in the 1980s that then became the Citizen Initiative of 1990 that created the safety belt law. And during last session, this body moved forward and became law, the requirement to use safety belts in vehicles that are used to transport people. We did not at that time have the conversation about vehicles that are created and used to transport property, but that is currently an exception in the safety belt law for the state of Oregon. This attempt is to be proactive and not have an incident occur that we then have to come forward and after the fact try and work on. The PowerPoint slides or the pictures of the vehicles that were attached to my testimony is basically walking you three types of vehicles that we're talking about. Generally, the first page and a half of vehicles are ones that you and I typically would say those are vehicles that are out there that are transporting property. Most of the time, particularly for the larger firms or the national firms, they've got a company policy, and in some cases, if these drivers are a commercial driver license holder or a CDL, they're required to wear their belts. But in some of the cases of these where they are maybe local or not part of a bigger operation, they don't very often have a policy for them to be able to wear belts unless it's part of their workers' compensation insurance package. If you turn to page 3, which then starts to show you examples of passenger vehicles, but that have been, if you will, modified by a sign or a placard that are now being used for purposes of transporting property, you now have a passenger vehicle that is expecting the users to be wearing belts for the airbags and the safety features to work. But technically now under law, if they are transporting property, they do not have to wear belts in the mainstream of the traffic flow. And then as Ms. Atkins had pointed out, if you turn to the very last set of photos in the very last page, you do have other vehicles that are somewhat in the middle. Can be passenger, can be for transport of property. And you have situations where individuals use these vehicles also to transport family or others, for instance, on the way to school, on the way to a job. The question then becomes, do they fit under the law or not? And current exemption is related to transport of property built and used for that purpose. They do not have to wear belts. In the state of Oregon, we only have 3% of the general population not wearing belts. 97% wear belts. One of the highest, number 3 in the country, probably one of the top 10 in the world. But that 3% represents 20% of our fatalities on our road system. We have 10 people every month in the state killed in traffic crashes not wearing their belts. One of the highest groups of not wearing belts is the pickup in the vehicles of this type. Yet we know that safety belts save lives, they make a difference, they reduce deaths to injuries to non-injury at all. Also from the business side, it makes sense. Part of the workers' compensation package, the insurance around the companies and the businesses. If people are buckled up and if they are in an unfortunate incident, then their injuries are less cost of business, less to have people come in and pick up a shift because someone can't make it. I do know when talking with other groups representing the associations of these companies and the other associations relating to the drivers, they are okay and in favor of this as well. And it can and will help reduce the death toll and injury toll, and help from a business point of view as far as insurance costs to the those companies that operate in the state of Oregon. And Mr. Chair, I'd be more than happy then to answer any questions about this bill that I can.
Okay. We might have some questions for Troy. Okay, I guess not. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Costello was the only one signed up on this bill. However, there are some people in the room who aren't just sitting here because they couldn't find a seat in the building. And so I would really kind of like, because you're here for a reason, to give us just a very brief comment on the bill so that we have a record that's a bit more extensive. I know we have people that represent trucks and businesses and contractors and grocery stores, maybe. I don't know. Restaurants.
Delivery boy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell, president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. My association supports House Bill 2275. We believe that seatbelts save lives, and we think it's a great bill and urge you to pass it.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica.
This is a participatory committee, so you can't just sit back here and, you know.
Jessica Adamson with AGC. We are very pro-safety in our organization. Anything that we can do to reduce on-the-job injuries, and that includes driving back and forth and around in our vehicles. We certainly encourage all of our members, whenever you're in a vehicle, buckle up. But this bill will save lives and will help reduce injuries, and that's a good thing for Oregon and for business.
Thank you. Very good and proper speech. Any questions for these two folks? Okay. We'll close public hearing. House Bill 2275. Open a work session on House Bill 2275.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2275 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2275 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be voting no on this bill. I spent some time talking with the Department of Transportation, and it's more of a philosophical basis, which is I encourage everybody to use their seatbelt, and before the voters pass it, I use my seatbelt. But I don't see why we need to be telling folks what to do at that level. So I'll be voting no. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other objections besides Senator George? Okay. Carries. Please mark the dissension of Senator George, and Senator Decker will be registered as excused. And I think we're done.
Do you want me to carry it?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Senator Starr, thank you very much. We all get a bill today. You know, we're all happy. All right, and we're adjourned.